chance to talk to that I know of, did not come from the central apparatus or from the Moscow directorate, which, you know, as you'd expect, is not a kind of typical regional directorate. It's a little bit like, to give an example, I mean, the British Metropolitan Police is technically the police for Greater London, less the City of London. But because of its size, because of its location, it also has a kind of strategic role in terms of providing central services that also cross the country. Well, to a degree, the Moscow FSB directorate is like that. No, he was from one of the genuine regional FSB directorates. And that gives him a very different perspective. And I once asked him what really his job was. And he framed it as this. It was making sure that if there's going to be a Russian solidarity movement, referring to the Polish trade union, which emerged in the shipyards of Gdansk at the end of the 1970s and then became a national movement and essentially forced the Polish government to declare martial law. Anyway, that if there's going to be a Russian solidarity, it doesn't happen in his region. Now, okay, I would suggest that his choice of metaphor reflected to a degree the fact that he came from a diplomatic family and his parents had been in Poland in the early 1980s. So, you know, he was obviously particularly exposed to that particular sort of idiom of national protest. But still, I mean, I do think it's interesting that he very much is looking for something that is going to start with the economy and then become political. And indeed can then, in the long term, bring down the regime. So I would suggest that lesson three from this crisis is that we may think that the regime looks really solid, but we should never underestimate the fears and paranoias of dictatorships and those peoples whose jobs it is to maintain them. And this probably goes doubly for Vladimir Putin. You know, remember, you know, he was there when East Germany collapsed. And how strong East Germany looked until really relatively, not even 11th hour, but 11th hour and maybe 59th minute. So we shouldn't be surprised the regime gets very worried when genuinely national, i.e. not regional or industry specific, economic problems arise that speak directly to absolutely fundamental questions of can you afford to eat? So the state's goal is precisely to try and prevent things from getting that bad before they have a serious problem. You know, prophylaxis, dealing with it first, that was a central element of the KGB under Yuri Andropov, who we're told Putin respects, or you know, regarded as a sort of a great figure. Well, I don't know if that's true or not, but I do know that if one looks at the current senior management within the FSB and beyond, these people are precisely of the Andropov generation. So they will very much look at, you know, they don't want to have to deal with crises, they want to prevent crises. And this is one of the reasons why, as well as using the apparatus of repression, you know, there have been a lot of efforts made to try and find new suppliers, which is a bit of a problem because, you know, for over a decade, Russia has been proudly near enough self-sufficient in eggs. They produce something like, I don't know, 98% of their own needs, topping up with some imports from Belarus, and that's it. But nonetheless, in December, in response to the sort of skyrocketing prices, the government temporarily lifted import duties on eggs for the next 6 months, and they also began soliciting emergency imports. And already we've had, what, about a million eggs from Azerbaijan arriving, and now Turkey is also moving into the market. We've had the first batch of 316,000 eggs arriving on the 3rd of January. May sound impressive, until you realise that in fact such is the size of this market that in order to have an appreciable impact on the price, you'd need to be basically getting in something like 500 million eggs each month. So in that context, 1.3 million is good enough for some newspaper stories saying things are changing, but not really going to change facts on the ground. But of course, you know, there are limits with this. The first of which is the fact that you'll need to be spending what we can go back to starting to call hard currency, valuta. Azerbaijan, certainly not Turkey, are not going to take rubles. So this is actually something in which the Russian economy, which in some ways is able to avoid the issue of the fact that the ruble is distinctly wobbly in price at the moment, because so much of its transfers are internal, it's ruble for ruble. But nonetheless, it is going to face problems when it has to import things, and eggs are just one more of them. And also, this becomes a political issue. It's worth noting, for example, at the Supreme Council of the Eurasian Economic Union, that's a title, that anyway, they met in St. Petersburg. Belarus's Lukashenko, who, after all, it's worth remembering, is a former collective farmer boss, couldn't resist a jab, saying, "We've achieved a high level of food self-sufficiency, which in Belarus is almost 100%. We cover our domestic needs in grain, pork, meat, poultry, milk, vegetables, vegetable oils, and eggs." And Putin, well, I mean, he kind of smiled and joked in reply, saying, "Oh, give us a little, don't be greedy." But I went back and actually looked at that footage, and I must admit, I did not think that Putin was exactly enjoying the joke there. So, two more lessons come out of this. First of all, that there are limits to how far Russia can depend on rubles. To a degree, what we're currently seeing is the Russian economy managing to not just flout sanctions, but in some ways flout basic economics. But there are limits to how far you can do that. And a second and much, much more specific little lesson that we still need to remember. Belarus is not simply a vassal state. Lukashenko may well be, to a considerable extent, dependent now on Putin, but he still has autonomy, and he clings to that. And why that matters is, again, that we have to bear in mind. When it comes down to it, Putin only has the friends he can afford to buy. Whether it's Belarus, whether it's China, whether it's African nations, or whatever, he has no allies. No one is going to give him anything. They may, on the other hand, be willing to sell him. So you can't expect there to be a dramatic change in the situation because of what happens outside Russia. No one is going to come to Russia's aid. And in this circumstance, Putin was even forced to make one of his rather rare apologies at last month's marathon direct line town hall come press conference. But of course, as ever, he blamed it on others. It wasn't a real apology. He called it a failure of the government's work. And it's worth mentioning that when one uses the specific form in this context of the government, what that means is the Council of Ministers. So he is dumping on someone else. As ever, his apology is essentially, "I apologise for trusting other people who screwed up." That's as far as you're ever going to get from Putin. But that also means a threat for others. So lesson number 6 is precisely that Putin will always dump the blame on other people. Even the smallest complex tasks, they fall to his underlings, whoever they may be. He will take the credit. The blame has to go somewhere else. And in this context, clearly, the person who's in the firing line, I mean, in part, it seems like Rasiel, I keep getting it mixed up, another one of these long, long sort of titles, Rasiel Khodznadzor, that's it, which is the Federal Service for Veterinary and Phytosanitary Surveillance. But primarily, not just the governors and so forth, but the Ministry of Agriculture. Now, let me just dwell on that. Who is the Minister for Agriculture? One Dmitry Patrushev, son of Nikolai Patrushev, Secretary of the Security Council. If you believe some of the wild rumours, the man who actually is in charge of the government now, which I don't believe. But on the other hand, one of the figures who is, as I've talked about in a previous podcast, generally profiled as a potential maybe Prime Minister, but maybe even President. As I said in that particular segment, I do have my doubts as to whether he'll be president, but still, his is one of the names that does tend to crop up. And now we find him very much in the firing line. You remember, I mean, actually, again, going back to that big press conference thing, he was the butt of, yes, I don't think that's a pun, of Putin's rather crude and crass joke. Where, using the Russian slang for testicles, he said that he'd asked the minister how his eggs were doing. Now, Putin does this. First of all, again, he likes to somehow, you know, sound a bit common and sound a bit sort of man of the people. But also, these quote-unquote jokes often tend to be regarded as warnings. I've got my eye on you. And certainly Patrushev Jr. seems to have realised this, because a few days later, at the United Russia Congress, you know, he admitted, I felt that I needed to work better, but still, probably I didn't really fully cope with the task. Nevertheless, I think that the president will give me one more chance to correct this price. You know, he may well feel the metaphorical, I should stress, high window gaping for him. Because 3 weeks ago, he predicted prices would decline within a month. And 2 weeks ago, he told Komsomolskaya Pravda, the newspaper, in the future, in order to prevent such distortions and act proactively, we will build a system for monitoring demand for all key food products. This will make it possible to quickly record if demand begins to grow somewhere and to orient the industry in advance to increase production volumes in this area. I mean, he is not a natural wordsmith, but remember that point about him actually also not just promising to do something about it, not just promising that prices will go down, but saying that this sort of system will be developed in order to orient the industry. So I'm going to come on to that later. So basically, Patrushev Jr. realizes that his career may be on the line. He's promised quite quick results in quite a specific time frame. And nonetheless, progress, frankly, so far at least, has been limited, has been patchy. And particularly interestingly, the degree to which, although it has some limited traction on the national media, it definitely has been toned down, but it's still, from looking around, dominating local news across the country. I mean, let me just give some examples. There's for example, Krasnoyarsk region. That's where prices had risen by 42% last year. But nonetheless, they were not sure, certainly the local authorities were quick to trumpet last week that the price of a dozen eggs had fallen from 149 to 119 rubles. So still a bit higher than people are used to, but nonetheless, you know, quite a distinct fall. Similarly, in Penza region, you had the local government very sort of proudly noting that the price of eggs there was 5% below the national average. On the other hand, if you are in Karelia, up in the northwest, well, there apparently fraudsters have been offering suspiciously cheap eggs online and simply pocketing the deposits paid up front by desperate or gullible punters. So lesson number 7 comes from this. We should always be aware of the regional dimension. And it's not just the obvious one of Moscow and maybe St. Petersburg versus the rest, or even urban versus rural. You know, there are huge variations in not just the quality of life, but the politics, even the outlook that we find across this huge country. You know, if you're in Khabarovsk or Blagoveshchensk on the Chinese border, what happens in Beijing is often almost as important as what happens in Moscow. And incidentally, there apparently the egg issue is much, much less of a problem. Why? Because eggs are being bought legally across the border, and even more importantly, on an even larger scale, illegally. If you are a shopper, you may, in say, Khabarovsk, you quite possibly just simply take the ferry across the river that is also the national border. You go to supermarkets in China, you buy the goods you want, and then you just simply take it back. No one's going to look in your bag. No one cares. So, I mean, in this respect, this is a useful reminder precisely of the fact of just how varied the perspectives are. And before I move on, I think it's time for a quick break, quick slurp of lemon tea, and then we will return to lessons 8, 9, and indeed 10. Just the usual mid-episode reminder that you're listening to the In Moscow Shadows podcast. Its corporate partner and sponsor is Conductor, which provides software for crisis exercises in hybrid warfare, counter-terrorism, civil affairs and the like. But you can also support the podcast yourself by going to patreon.com/inmoscowshadows. And remember that patrons get a variety of additional perks depending on their tier, as well as knowing that they're supporting this peerless source on all things Russian. And you can also follow me on Twitter at Mark Galeotti, or on Facebook, Mark Galeotti on Russia. Now, back to the episode. Now, before I resume my egg-related ruminations, just a quick note. Obviously, my patrons had their 12 days of shadowy Christmas, various bits and pieces sent their way. Two elements of those, which were book review segments, will be coming out for general sort of consumption towards the end of this month. The first one covers Thomas Graham's Getting Russia Right, Richard Sakwa's The Lost Peace, and Leon Aron's Riding the Tiger. And the second one, Maria Popova and Oksana Chevelle's Russia and Ukraine, Simon Schuster's The Showman on Zelensky, and Andrew Harding's A Small Stubborn Town. Now, as I said, these will be coming out generally, so you'll have a couple of little mini podcasts available. But I plan to have a few more book review, you know, comparative book review segments. Feedback would be very greatly appreciated. Do you like these things? Do you like the approach taken? And generally, are there other books in particular you'd like me to cover? I have, as you'd imagine, a stack of read, unread, half-read books that I at some point would like to talk about. But again, any recommendations, much appreciated. So, to return to matters eggy. Now, the real problem is that, look, while this crisis was obviously exacerbated by the usual human failings of hoarding, panic buying, profiteering, it also reflects, and again, something I've mentioned in the past, some really quite fundamental challenges that are facing the Russian economy. Because, look, it seems to be doing really well, weathering the storm of sanctions, GDP up, whatever it is, 3% maybe. But all the same, although the issue is, well, as far as the government is claiming, the issue is that buoyant household income has led to overconsumption, which is a bit of a strange thing. And how often do people say, I'm feeling really rather solvent. Let us buy some more eggs and eat them. Not least because in that case you'd imagine there to be underconsumption somewhere else. Actually, the issue is the very opposite. You know, as ever, government's attempts to spin tend to wander into the realms of outright falsehood. Actually, salaries overall, and I'd stress that overall because there are key variations, especially if you work in the defence industrial complex, but overall they're not keeping up with inflation, which is 7.5% across the board, but actually a lot of food products and other sort of, you know, key elements of the household budget, it's distinctly more. And in particular, what we've seen is pricier sources of protein becoming, frankly, unaffordable or, you know, much less affordable within the general household budget. So fish, beef, pork and the like are being substituted by chicken, and even that rose in price by 28% last year, and eggs as cheaper ways of eking out the diet. So lesson number 8 is that life in Russia is unlike the Tsar Ivan's. In other words, it's not great, it's not terrible. But that doesn't mean that it is not definitely eroding in quality for most. Now again, this is a slow indicator. It's not actually as if there's a sudden thing. And this is why actually the egg issue is so politically worrying for the regime, because it was so quick. In most cases, it's just that bit that, you know, your belt needs to be tightened a little bit more. The amount of extra assets you felt you would have at the end of the year, well, it's not there anymore. Those little petty luxuries that you'd look forward to being able to acquire, no, that's not going to be next year. Again, these things tend to be lagging indicators, but they nonetheless are definitely indicators. Life is getting harder. It's not getting harder dramatically, quickly, but nonetheless, bit by bit, that is happening. There's no way of getting around it so long as, first of all, the war continues. Secondly, sanctions continue. And thirdly, the deformations to the overall economy caused by the war and sanctions continue. What investment resources there are have been channeled to the defence industrial sector, reopening new lines, production lines, moving to 7 day a week, 24/7 production. In some cases, you know, starting to produce homegrown variants of Iranian drones, etc. But what that has meant is there just isn't any really for the civilian sector. And that's very, very strikingly clear. And if you look at the food production and processing sector, well, this still remains pretty much antiquated. And so it's very much hit by rising energy prices because it's not very efficient, but also rising wage costs, particularly as in some cases it is having to compete with the opportunities in the military, but also in the defence industries. So you're having to basically outbid the defence plants to get workers. You're usually not being able to do that. So fewer workers are arguably having to do more work in machinery that's getting older and older. That's not a recipe for particular success. And it also tends to mean that this sector lacks the reserves to deal with unexpected reversals. And we've had those for them. The falling value of the ruble, for example, I mean, that makes imported machinery and vaccines and similar, and indeed packaging, you know, something as basic as packaging, which much of it has to be imported. Well, that is obviously now much more expensive. Likewise, I mean, even something as apparently unconnected as an increase in measles cases in Russia. Now, I don't know the actual root cause of this, but nonetheless, it is clear there have been a variety of measles outbreaks, and that has led to an increase in vaccination, as you'd expect. And that, in turn, has meant more domestic vaccine production. But the point is, the measles vaccine is based on chicken protein. Everything connects to everything else. So you need more vaccines, you need to use more chicken in that, which means there is less chicken available for egg production or meat, and therefore laws of supply and demand mean up it goes. There just isn't the spare. There isn't that sense of, you know, anything that is available. So this is lesson number 9, the degree to which the economy is under pressure, but not necessarily in the kind of headline ways. You know, that 3% GDP increase, similar upbeat data notwithstanding, you know, we have to unpick the impact of military Keynesianism, of massive spending at the moment, which clearly to a degree also means more money in people's pockets and the like. But unpick that from the impact on the rest of the economy. And what we see, and this is something that frankly Elvira Nabiullina of the Central Bank has been quite clear, using this parallel that sure, you can drive a car as fast as you can for as long as you can, but in due course that damages the car. Well, this is what we're actually seeing. Is an economy that actually does not have margins, does not have spare reserves of capital, production, raw materials and the like, and therefore it doesn't take much to send it out of kilter. With Putin facing re-election in March, this is exactly the kind of thing he does not want to see. Why? Look, again, the obvious thing, this is not a vote that he's going to lose, but if he is to accrue the kind of gains in credibility and legitimacy that in the election is meant, or the election theatrical spectacular, is meant to provide, then he does not want some kind of symbolic issue around which some kind of incohate coalition of just natural fed-upness can gather. You know, therefore, this has to be sorted. He needs a fix, and what is the kind of fix that a government like his naturally turns to? Well, I have a feeling that this is going to be one more factor that actually encourages, despite the instincts of many of it, the people within it, but nonetheless pushes the government willy-nilly into renewed state control. Now again, go back to what Patrushev was saying. We've already had the Ministry of Agriculture proposing not just a temporary export ban, but also direct price fixing. And Patrushev's promise to sort of orient the industry in advance to increase production volumes wherever he thinks it's needed speaks to a much greater role for intervention from the government apparatus over the economy. And therefore, Russia's egg crisis is not only a symptom of wider economic problems and indeed a political challenge, it may well also nudge the regime into more, no doubt, what are intended as temporary, but the temporary can very quickly become the business-as-usual status quo. Anyway, into temporary intervention and control over the economy. In other words, further into the kind of Soviet practices that we know did work so, so well before. So this is lesson number 10. The more that this particular crisis continues, and the more we have similar crises, resulting on the fact that there just isn't really the adaptability within the system, and the Russians are no longer in the state in which they can actually turn to the global market easily in order to make up for shortfalls in domestic production. Anyway, the more this goes on, the more Putin's Russia, which we must note, originally started out fairly socially liberal, but certainly economically ultra-liberal. Anyway, the more it will drift into, if not North Koreanization, but certainly late Sovietism. And as I said, we know how well that worked. But while it didn't work particularly well for ordinary people, and while it didn't work particularly well for keeping up with the constant and accelerating changes in sort of global economy and technology, nonetheless, we also have to recognise just how surprisingly durable that system was. Again, it's too easy to focus on its collapse in the late 80s. But remember that, you know, it had arguably been limping on for, I don't know, really at least 15 years. It was essentially in crisis. And it collapsed arguably because of Gorbachev. Now, I don't want to sound like Putin here, but nonetheless, we have to recognise that it was precisely because Gorbachev believed in the system, thought it could be renovated, thought it could be reformed, that actually he brought about the changes that led to its collapse. If we had seen either a bland consensus manager like Brezhnev, or a kind of authoritarian reformer of the sort of Andropov, I don't know, maybe that system would have survived even longer. The point I'm making is that, you know, this may well help push the system into an essentially self-destructive and moribund model. But we should recognise that that doesn't mean necessarily a quick process of collapse. It's not going to work in the long term, but the long term is really quite long. But I don't want to end on such a downbeat note, so let me conclude with a little, let's call it a little Easter egg of a story which I heard from the town of Solikamsk, a salt town in Perm region off in Siberia. And there a local person who had bought two eggs opened them up and found that in one the pattern in the yolk was reminiscent of the Virgin Mary. And in the other, it turned out the pattern in the yolk somehow evoked the face of Vladimir Putin. Clearly, this is a sign. Of what? Well, I'll leave that up to you to decide. Happy Orthodox Christmas. Well, that's the end of another episode of the In Moscow Shadow podcast. Just as a reminder, beyond this, you can follow my blog, also called In Moscow Shadows. Follow me on Twitter, at Mark Galliotti, or Facebook, Mark Galliotti on Russia. This podcast is made possible by generous and enlightened patrons, and you too can be one. Just go along to my Patreon page, that's patreon.com/inmoscowshadows, and decide which tier you want to join, getting access to exclusive materials and other perks. However, whether or not you contribute, thank you very much indeed for listening. Until next time, keep well.
Oh, the summertime is coming. Sweetly blooming, and the one
Hinhält. Ich war, als ich dich ansah, wann? Draußen, bei den anderen Welten. Oh, diese Wege galaktisch, oh, diese Stunde, die uns die Nächte herüberwog, in die Last unserer Namen. Es ist, ich weiß es, nicht wahr, dass wir lebten. Es ging blind nur ein Atem zwischen dort und nicht da und zuweilen. Kometenhaft schwirrt da ein Aug aufs Erloschene zu, in den Schluchten, da, wo es verglühte, stand sitzenprächtig die Zeit, an der schon empor und hinab und hinweg wuchs. Was ist oder war oder sein wird. Ich weiß und du weißt, wir wussten nicht, wir waren ja da und nicht dort. Und zuweilen, wenn nur das Nichts zwischen uns stand, fanden wir ganz zueinander.
Thank you. Dat kan heel goed, ja, ja, ja.
Een baarn misschien nog?
Niet een baarn, maar van de No Border
kamp. Oh, dat was het, ja. Ja,
en
ja, ja,
ja, ja. Joke Caviar's dichtbundel. Dat was ook bij.
Ja, 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 ja. Ja, nou, dat zijn mooie ontmoetingen.
Absoluut, toch? Zeker. Ik dat zag je al, ik dacht van, goed dat je hier bent.
Ja, ja, want ze stonden flink te ruzie, want je mag niet de vergelijking trekken tussen VOC, NSB en PVV.
Nee.
Nou, ik vind de overeenkomst overduidelijk. Het is allemaal drie letters.
Ja, maar dit is...
Maar het is een belangrijke geschiedenisles. En we zijn hier om te herdenken, toch? Ja. En om te leren van de geschiedenis.
Het is een apolitieke bijeenkomst, dit natuurlijk. Ja. Hè? Dat
lijkt me sterk.
Ja, dat lijkt me ook, dat lijkt me ook sterk. Ja, het is toch proberen ze.
Het is in principe een nationalistische bijeenkomst. Serieus.
Ja, nee, dat is waar.
Niet voor mij, maar voor de meesten die hier zijn. Ja. Liberaal nationalistisch. Het gaat niet over antifascisme, het gaat erover dat Nederland bezet is.
Ja.
En ooit.
Ja, vroeger, weet je wel. Ja, nou
ja,
is niks en
ja, het is, je kunt net zo goed ook de VOC verheerlijken. Daar kun je ook naartoe.
Ja.
Dan kun je ook hier naartoe, maakt niet uit.
Ja, dat was Balken. En die, was, die had dat geprobeerd hè, met de VOC. Maar dat was toch een beetje moeilijk om daar een positief verhaal
Laten we niet vergeten dat tot diep in de jaren 60 waren communisten, communistische... verzet in de Tweede Wereldoorlog, dat was de gebeten hond.
Ja.
Er was überhaupt geen herdenking van de Holocaust, tot diep in de jaren 60.
Ja, ja, ja. Maar de februaristaking is voor een heel belangrijk deel veroorzaakt door de communisten.
Ja.
De communisten en de antifascisten, de anarchisten, dat zijn de
voor een belangrijk deel door Joodse communisten.
Vooral,
ook nog. Ja. Zeker.
Dus, maar er is zometeen ook nog een wandeling. Ik weet niet of jullie dat
daar zijn we voor. Okay. We zijn niet voor deze nationalistische optocht.
Ah, oké. Okay. Ja, ja. Ik kom ook net aanlopen. Dus, ik neem aan dat zometeen wel ergens verzameld. Er
zullen ongetwijfeld mensen met goede bedoelingen staan. Maar het zijn ik vooral de liberale goede bedoelingen. En dat is waar het land dan kapot gaat.
Ja.
Al liberale goede bedoelingen. Ja. Als er al liberale goede bedoelingen zijn.
Ja.
Maar de vraag. Maar als ze er zijn, dan gaan we daar kapot aan.
Het wordt tijd om wat leibandjes los te gooien, geloof ik. Even kijken hoe het daar verder is. Ik ga nog even wat...
veel succes.
Actie of zo? Of is er nog actie? Is er nog iets gebeurd dat je weet hier of zo?
Ja, de organisatie die kwam verhaal halen. Dat is wat ik ervan begreep. En die zei dat hier geen plaats was voor een demonstratie. Vond ik een beetje vreemd, want volgens mij hoort dit het is een demonstratie van antifascisme, zou je zeggen. Maar ja, maar het was vooral een gesprek. Er heeft één iemand geprobeerd het doek naar beneden te trekken.
Oh,
maar daar stopt het bij. En vooralsnog mogen ze blijven staan. En er werd een beetje geduwd net, de politie wel. Maar ja, daar blijft het nu bij.
Het lijkt nu wel stabiel.
Voor mij wel, ja.
Nou, ik ga nog even aan een stokvasthouder vragen hoe het ermee gaat.
Heel
Quand tout devient silence, lorsque
le jour est fini,
que mes rêves commencent, alors je pense à lui, avant de dormir, je rêve à tout ce qu'il m'a dit, à tout ce qu'il va me dire, et je revois aussi combien ses yeux me regardaient d'un air heureux. Chaque fois qu'il disait « Je t'aime », j'étais dans ses bras et rien ne comptait plus, non, plus rien autour de moi, nous étions tous deux seuls dans la rue. Je pense à lui et quand je m'endors dans tous mes rêves de la nuit, c'est lui que je revois. Quand la nuit s'achève, qu'à nouveau le soleil lui, je continue mon rêve en ne pensant qu'à lui. Quand je m'endors dans tous mes rêves de la nuit, c'est lui que je revois, lui encore, c'est lui que je revois, lui encore, c'est lui que je revois, lui encore.
Fight it, fight it, fight.
fight, fight, fight.